was sitting on Friday trying to think about what kind of topic I should choose for my podcast and killing two birds with one stone, the Dharma talk today. And I was looking down my list of topics. I have a whole list on the podcast website of, possible upcoming episodes, and I just could not, I could not bring myself, at least for this, on this particular day, to just choose a topic that was divorced from the climate and ecological emergency. I couldn't just come and talk about the Lotus Sutra or mindfulness or whatever. And, I'm aware that there might be some of you who, like, all right, how much are we going to talk about this? I get tired of talking about it. I get tired of hearing about it. This is a Zen Buddhist group, not a climate activism group. But I'm going to propose something today that I think you might find interesting and helpful. And I'm going to tie it back to Buddhism. So, just to briefly bear witness and touch base, one of the reasons that I, some of the reasons that I can't, I couldn't just do a Buddhism only topic is, rain fell at the summit of Greenland for the first time in human history. The second largest fire in California history has caused the evacuation of thousands and continues to rage. And out of the 20 largest fires in California since they began keeping good records in 1932, 10 of them have occurred in the last 5 years. Half of them have occurred in the last 5 years. I went camping last night. And as I'm driving out in the gorge, just huge numbers of trees that are just scorched brown in a way that I've never, ever, ever seen before in my life. And I know because of what happened in my backyard that a lot of that was happened during the few days of the heat dome. Now, I'm sure it was exacerbated by ongoing drought and stuff, but like, that amount of damage happened in like 3 days. So I was like, ah. So what kind of episode can I, what kind of, talk, what kind of podcast episode could I produce? I want to touch people. I want to support practice. I want to celebrate Buddhism and Zen. So what my the summary of what I'm going to say today is that I think it would be very positive and helpful if we, as individuals, as communities, as states, as nations, declared war on global heating and ecological destruction. So I'm going to explain my thinking. We declared war on this crisis and shifted into a wartime mindset. So I'll be getting into why that is. And then I'll be talking about, well, how does that fit with Buddhist practice, seeing as war sounds aggressive and violent, and war has enemies and usually involves death and destruction and weapons. As I've talked about before, Zen is about facing the truth. And even though, common sense tells us that, it would be best to, if something's really daunting and painful, the best thing to do is just to kind of enjoy yourself, distract yourself, develop coping mechanisms, whatever. Like, but But just to go straight into the truth, the difficulty, doesn't, like, that's not common sense, right? But that is what Zen asks us to do. That is what, you know, it's counterintuitive, but it says we can actually be more free, happier, even at peace, feel stronger, less exhausted if we do this. So I've already mentioned a few things that we're facing, but, you know, why, in order to declare, argue for declaring war, like, the situation has to be really bad. And I don't know that most of us are there yet. You know, we're like, geez, that's too bad. You know, that's, you know, there's a lot of fires and there's a lot of storms, but, you know, I mean, there's always been massive changes on Earth, and, you know, we'll cope and we'll get air purifiers and we'll live with it. But the massive changes that people love to talk about, that have happened, you know, extinctions and climate changes and all this, which is entirely true, that never happened with human civilization clinging to the planet. All of that predates our life, the way life as we know it. So change at the scale and speed that we're talking about is something that just our structures are going to be incapable of adapting to unless we really take action. And then there are, and I won't spend too much longer on this aspect, there are the looming possibilities, of which I imagine many of you are aware, of the abrupt and catastrophic changes to our planetary systems, like ocean currents, or like methane exploding out of the Arctic, that could just, like, you know, unleash much more than just, like, okay, here's heating, here's, you know, worse storms and whatever, but a massive catastrophic changes. And I know there's, you know, as scientists report this stuff, it's in their professionalism. They never say this is going to happen, right? It's always about probabilities. That's science. That's the way science works. So they're going to say, oh, you know, it's probably not going to happen within our lifetime. It might not happen. It might happen in 10 years. It might happen in 100 years. But then I was thinking about it, and we seize on that doubt, right? Like, well, maybe it's not going to happen at all. Maybe they're wrong. But then I thought, what if somebody told you there was a giant sinkhole developing under your house, but it's probably not going to collapse and swallow you and all your loved ones up in the middle of the night? Probably not. You know, there's only about a 10% chance that might happen in the next 10 years. But, you know, how would you respond to that? Would you, like, oh, that sounds pretty good, that's pretty good odds? Or would you, like, get out of your house till, like, everything was dealt with? So we don't want this situation to be true. We don't want it to be that bad. Maybe the problem will go away. Maybe someone else will take care of it. So, as many of you know, I've been wrestling with this for a long time. So why this? I'm actually finding this idea of shifting into a wartime mindset very encouraging. Something is coming together for me in a way that it hasn't for a very long time. So we need, I'm arguing, and you don't have to swallow it. You can give me your honest feedback afterwards. I'm arguing that we need to recognize and come to terms with the fact that we're no longer living in peacetime. That preventing the complete breakdown of Earth's natural life support systems must take priority over everything else. that this isn't just one issue among many, many important, noble issues, you know, conserving this plot of land, working on literacy, improving our education system. You know, there's all kinds of wonderful, wonderful things. But this is the most critical problem of all, threatening the end of life as we know it. So it's kind of like we've come upon a sick and starving baby in a burning house. And absolutely, the baby needs medical attention and the baby needs food. Absolutely, there's just no denying that. But first, we got to get her out of the burning house. So I was inspired to pick up this idea of mine. I forgot to bring the book, but I think I've mentioned it on my August 1st podcast or Dharma Talk. A book by Margaret Klein Solomon called Facing the Climate Emergency: How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. And I would love every person alive to read this book. It is short, it's to the point, personal, practical. So Solomon compassionately addresses our human responses: denial, intellectualization, willful ignorance, dissociation, and encourages us to face the truth. And her arguments aren't Zen, but it's very aligned with Zen thinking. She's a psychologist. And she makes the case, as many people have, that we can only be saved now by a society-wide mobilization, such as that undertaken by the US during World War II. And she talks about shifting from normal mode into emergency mode, and has a little handy chart of what these different modes mean. And one of them is during normal mode, in normal mode, we have many balanced priorities and our resources is distributed across those priorities. And some resources are saved for the future. But in emergency mode, you know, one crisis takes priority and all the, you know, I mean, not all, but, you know, massive reallocation of resources goes toward that main crisis. And interestingly, she also says in normal mode, we derive our self-esteem from our personal or individual accomplishments, or our you know, satisfaction from kind of our individual journeys and lives. But in emergency mode, we derive it from our contributions to the solution. Good question. I'll go ahead and I'll type in the name of the book. So this is Margaret Klein Solomon is the author, and it's Facing the Climate Emergency. And it's a book about practice. You know, it's a book about how do you really live with this and deal with this. So the more that I thought about her ideas, and I actually have a way of getting in contact with her, so I might discuss this with her. The more I thought about that, I thought, well, when, you know, the most familiar way we have of going into emergency mode is kind of wartime thinking. It's declaring war on something. And I'm thinking, like, this is the best way for us to make sense of what's going on and spur ourselves and our governments to take the radical action needed. Even those of us unfamiliar with living through a war know what wartime means. It means we're all in this together against a common threat. We need to temporarily set aside our differences and work together, even with people that we ordinarily might despise or avoid. It means a time to sacrifice for the common good. It means it's time to be brave and do your best while facing, you know, perhaps terrifying situations. It means it's time to be noble instead of self-absorbed and whiny. It's time to ask ourselves what's really important. You know, is it our material comfort and pleasure? Or is it, you know, life and our family members and, you know, the continuation of human civilization? So to get to the point about Buddhism then, so how can a Buddhist be advocating waging war? You know, that's kind of that's an aggressive kind of attitude. But there are, of course, other kinds of wars besides those involving human beings killing one another with weapons. So we have the tradition of the Bodhisattva, a being who not only vows to pursue enlightenment, but to free all living beings before they retire into eternal peace. So this is one of my favorite passages. This is by the 13th Dalai Lama before this one. And it goes like this. The Bodhisattva is like the mightiest of warriors, but her enemies are not common foes of flesh and bone. His fight is with the inner delusions, the afflictions of self-cherishing and ego-grasping, those most terrible of demons that catch living beings in the snares of confusion and cause them to forever wander in pain, frustration, and sorrow. Her mission is to harm ignorance and delusion, never living beings. These he looks upon with kindness, patience, and empathy, cherishing them like a mother cherishes her only child. She is the real hero, calmly facing any hardship in order to bring peace, happiness, and liberation to the world. So standing up for what is right against what is wrong and destructive, fiercely demanding change, doesn't have to involve hatred or enemies or aggression. And history has shown us actually that it's entirely possible to push governments and societies. It's not an easy thing, and it's not an easy thing to make happen anytime you want it, but it's possible to push massive changes nonviolently. And in fact, research suggests that to do this nonviolently is actually more effective and more reliable than doing it through, you know, armed revolution or insurrection. They've done studies, and when that happened, when it's violent, like, it's a good chance that you're going to slide into something like totalitarianism afterwards. So you have a better chance of kind of sustaining the changes that you fought for if you do it nonviolently. So in this sense, the ideals of Buddhism and the ideas of nonviolent civil resistance overlap beautifully. The 13th Dalai Lama describes how the Bodhisattva never harms living beings, but looks upon them with kindness, patience, and empathy. And in effective nonviolent resistance, we also seek to stop or promote certain actions, but we don't devolve into hatred or blame. So one of the core values in Extinction Rebellion says we avoid blaming and shaming. We live in a toxic system, but no one individual is to blame. And we function this way not only because it's moral, but because it's actually effective. As you know, like confronting people with judgment and hatred and aggression just usually makes them dig in further. Whereas what we're hoping for is converting enough hearts and minds that the tables turn. So, with respect to the climate emergency, for instance, we pin our hopes on the fact, and this is where I think just, Buddhism, probably some other traditions as well, but Buddhism can really inform how we approach this. No one is actually happy living a life of self-cherishing and ego-grasping. No one is actually happy in a deep and lasting way, clinging just to material pleasures and fulfilling their greed. No one is actually at peace in willful ignorance and delusion, thinking it's possible to simply maximize our, material enjoyment, our wealth, at the expense of the natural world, through exploiting other living beings. So we have great examples in this, Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others, faced huge resistance and repercussions to their actions, great brutality, but they always preached love, even for their enemies. And of course, the Buddha in the Dhammapada said, hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. So that is the course, the background. That is the spiritual argument for, like, okay, we're not talking about judgment or aggression or hatred when we're talking about this waging war. But that said, the imagery of war and battle and fierceness unlocks something deep inside us. We evolve to protect ourselves and our families, and then, societies developed, and we learn to include our tribe in that. And our urge to protect life is pure. It's not based in hatred or greed. It doesn't have to be tied up in complex agendas or our sense of identity or our politics. The urge to protect life is what brings people together during natural disasters, acts of great heroism and generosity. So this is what I find inspiring. When we're fighting a war, everyone is needed. You may be on the front lines, or you may be sending food to the front lines, or darning socks for those on the front lines. You may be planting a victory garden so there are more resources available for those fighting the war. Or you might be broadcasting music or humor to keep up the morale of the troops. You accept rationing with pride instead of anger, and respond with frugality and ingenuity, because you understand that, this sacrifice is being made for a greater purpose. And because you are doing what you can, whatever little way that you can contribute, you can feel pride in any victories. You're emotionally invested in the war effort. How are we doing? What are the reports? Oh, we won. We won that thing. Uh-oh, we lost that thing. Oh. And maybe our contribution is maintenance of our families and communities. So there's a reason for the war to be won, right? To keep the home fires burning. And then even when the situation looks dire, you understand that you have to keep hope alive and not give up. And you have to encourage those around you. And if your courage flags, you try to kind of just deal with it or hide it, you seek some support, but you need to resume your strength as soon as possible. Giving up is not an option. So I think in terms of our climate and ecological emergency, which, to some extent is just it's just the most extreme symptom of a way we have been living on this planet that is completely and utterly unsustainable. The list just multiplies every day of just, we can't keep doing this. We're drinking plastic in our water. We're like, melting the ice caps. We're changing the ocean currents. We're, using up all of our resources as if there's no tomorrow. They just can't go on. So, identifying this and declaring, war on it, we need to get ourselves, get our communities, get our society to recognize the necessity for it and then demand our governments declare it. And it's tricky because those invested in continuing business as usual for as long as possible, they don't live across the ocean from us. They're among us. They are us to some extent. We're all invested in the way that things are to some extent. So this is why we have to remember this is not declaring war on people. This is declaring war on greed, hate, and delusion, and how they manifest. So in Buddhism, traditionally, it's really focused on waging war, on doing a battle against the greed, hate, and delusion within ourselves. And now it's time to take that same practice and that same determination and apply it to the greed, hate, and delusion that is manifesting in our communities, our states, our nations, our economies, etc. So it may seem at times like we're facing impossible odds, but we know human beings are capable of incredible, even unimaginable things. It wasn't a pleasant thing, but we did bring the entire world to a halt when COVID hit. Something that, like, before that, nobody, like, that is, no, that can't happen, wouldn't happen. I saw this video. It's music by this accordionist that I love, and he puts together these videos, and it's so poignant. He did all of these scenes from major cities, Rome and New York and Singapore and all over the world, these major cities, empty, empty. And it's just chilling and mind-boggling. Like that is the thing that we will watch post-pandemic to be like, right, I forgot about that. That is, you really, it's amazing. A negative thing, but it is does show what we're capable of if we identify a problem. And then the list of amazing, innovative solutions are almost endless. I don't know if you're familiar with the book Drawdown, but it's just packed with, how we could farm differently, how we could build our houses differently, how we could structure society differently. It's like the answers are out there if we had the political will to apply them. So I'm going to leave you with the most inspiring story I know. And this is related in the book Active Hope: How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone. And Joanna Macy is a Buddhist, a longtime activist and Buddhist teacher. So she is relating this. There's different versions of this prophecy, but apparently it's a 12 centuries old Tibetan Buddhist prophecy about the Shambhala warriors. And this is the version that her teacher, Dugu Chogyal Rinpoche, gave to her. There comes a time when all life on earth is in danger. Barbarian powers have arisen, Although they waste their wealth in preparations to annihilate each other, they have much in common. Weapons of unfathomable devastation and technologies that lay waste to the world. It is now, when the future of all beings hangs by the frailest of threads, that the kingdom of Shambhala emerges. You cannot go there, for it is not a place. It exists in the hearts and minds of the Shambhala warriors. But you cannot recognize a Shambhala warrior by sight, for there is no uniform or insignia, there are no banners, and there are no barricades from which to threaten the enemy. For the Shambhala warriors have no land of their own. Always they move on the terrain of the barbarians themselves. Now comes the time when great courage is required of the Shambhala warriors, moral and physical courage. For they must go into the very heart of the barbarian power and dismantle the weapons. To remove these weapons, in every sense of the word, they must go into the corridors of power where the decisions are made. The Shambhala warriors know they can do this, because the weapons are mano maya, mind made. This is very important to remember. These weapons are made by the human mind. They can be unmade by the human mind. The Shambhala warriors know that the dangers that threaten life on Earth do not come from evil deities or extraterrestrial powers. They arise from our own choices and relationships. So now the Shambhala warriors must go into training. They train in the use of two weapons. The weapons are compassion and insight. Both are necessary. We need compassion because it provides us the fuel. It moves us out to act on behalf of other beings. But by itself, it can burn us out. So we need the second as well, which is insight into the dependent co-arising of all things. It lets us see that the battle is not between good people and bad people. For the line between good and evil runs through every human heart. We realize that we are interconnected as in a web, and that each act with pure motivation affects the entire web, bringing consequences we cannot measure or even see. But insight alone can seem too cool to keep us going. So we need as well the heat of compassion, our openness to the world's pain. Both weapons or tools are necessary to the Shambhala warrior. So I always get a chill down my spine or tears in my eyes when I read these weapons are mano maya. They are mind made. This is about human choices and relationships. Therefore, it is entirely possible to shift them. It's not easy. It's not easy to shift human choices and relationships, but we do know from experience that compassion and wisdom are every bit as core a part of the human being as greed, hate, and delusion. So just in closing, I guess, you know, what are you supposed to do with this suggestion, right? I guess what I would recommend is just kind of sitting with this idea of moving into a wartime mindset. And you know, letting your own heart and mind feel that out. You know, for me, it feels, it just kind of makes some sense out of it. Like, I know how to do that. I know how to respond in that way, even though I've never been, like, lived actively through, you know, my society being affected in a big way by war, but I know how to do that. I find it encouraging to think of other people also recognizing that and supporting one another in that effort, recognizing that this isn't a battle you go out and fight by yourself, that we have to do this together. So just kind of getting used to this mentally and emotionally, but also then, if we do this as a sangha, things can shift. And it becomes, and we may be at the cutting edge or the forefront of this movement into thinking this way and orienting ourselves this way. I mean, I know that in terms of Zen centers, we're at the cutting edge, but I don't think it'll be long before others follow, because they'll have to, because this will be the reality of our lives. So I think the sooner that we can start getting used to this and look for the positives in it. So instead of it being like, oh God, here's another Dharma talk where we talk about climate change, it just being, all right, this is the new environment that we are living in. And in a sense, everything is affected by it. Everything is taking place in that context. And that doesn't mean there aren't times to just, not talk explicitly about it and study something else and study that that weapon of wisdom that he talks about, that sense of, being able to have perspective on this and find points of strength and calm. But, well, there it is. So I will, we have 15 whole minutes. If you want to ask a question or make a comment, you're very, very welcome to. And I want to say, as I have hopefully before, like you don't, I'm not looking for people to just agree and say, oh, that's wonderful, Domyo. I mean, if you think it's wonderful, that's great. But I don't want anyone who might feel like, I don't know about this, to just leave. I want, this is about engaging this wholeheartedly. So, Marv.
Two quick comments. First, have you thought about making this Solomon book or Tuesday night book reading next?
What I thought I might do for balance is maybe alternate Tuesdays, so that on, one Tuesday, we're studying a book of teachings, like the one that just came out by one of my teachers. And then on alternate Tuesdays, we might do that.
Second, what about the issue of culture and the inertia that implies in getting people to change their minds?
Well, I don't know. I guess when... I don't know if this is really true, but I guess there's a little part of me that feels hopeful that the idea of, look, we have this crisis, let's go into wartime mode and work on it. And in the meantime, we're from opposite sides of the political spectrum or whatever, but we set that, like, we'll argue later and get to work on this thing. So I think that the simplicity of it might appeal to people of different cultures and political stripes. I'm hoping certainly more than a kind of lefty environmental agenda will appeal. more widely. So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Well, I'm thinking not only in terms of the way you put it, but for example, one of the reasons why the powerful countries of the world have not done much, the governments and the corporations, is because we want so much to preserve our affluence. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, I think that's cultural. Mm-hmm. The sense that we're entitled to it and the rest of the world doesn't matter that much. And if climate change is hitting the global south worst, then we'll be all right. I think that affects a lot of people. That's why I'm worried about basic change in values.
I can't say that I am hopeful, but it occurs to me that, you know, and I don't generally anthropomorphize Mother Earth, but you could, you know, I've heard it say sometimes, like, you know, Mother Earth is now teaching us a lesson. And I have hope that because now we are like, we are all in this together. It's a global thing. Like we cannot, and in this case, like what you're talking about, if we do not transfer technology and wealth to the less developed nations, we won't get out of the climate crisis, period, because they will continue building coal plants and trying to get themselves out of poverty, and this is not gonna work. So I feel like maybe we're not gonna save ourselves from extinction, but in the process of like just now, we've never faced something like this, which is so clearly global. You know, what somebody does on the other side of the planet doesn't stay there. So I hope some of that, like the justice will be, you know, fit right in there.
I didn't mean to say we should be pessimistic because of all of that. What I meant to say is that should be a target.
But to be honest, I think, you know, those of us who align with certain values and culture think, well, that is good, and that's the right way it should be, and that's the way it should have been for a long time, is more fairness and justice. But honestly, those people who are clutching their wealth, I don't know that that argument is going to convince them. But the argument, like, well, you're going to go down in flames along with everybody else clutching your wealth if you don't give some of it away, then so I think some of that wealth transfer is going to happen not because of nobility or even because of doing that for its own sake, but because it's just necessary. Pat.
I have to say that I got that book after the last time you mentioned it, what's her name? With the Facing the Climate Change.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get through the first chapter. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that so I never got to her premise in depth. I mean, I've heard what you've had to say, but I've never really, I don't own it yet myself. But it seemed like the enemy was corporations. And when you said, well, you were not doing a war between people, I almost have to weigh in on whether corporations are people or not, but I don't want to go there. But I realized that the things that are really driving me nuts are not global. Or they are kind of, but not exactly. Mm-hmm. I have been fascinated with COVID, and I read all of the newsletters from New York Times and Washington Post, and I'm really always trying to find out what the current research is. And so in the last couple of weeks, I realized that I thought I should get a third shot because that would make me safer. And then the next piece of news that came up is all the countries that have people were 2%, or 3% or 4% have the first vaccination. And I thought, should I be pleading for a third shot for myself from this affluent country I live in, when we can't figure out how to globally have enough compassion for these poor people who are in war-torn countries and in poverty and so I'm struggling. And so that issue like ends up being so prominent in my mind that I don't know how to change it, but it's personal then, because should I stop advocating for my third vaccination? If I just let myself, I can kind of ruminate on it. And the next one that kind of keeps in my mind is, I have been completely unsuccessful for my entire adult life in eliminating plastic bags from my own home. As a person who wants to make changes, that doesn't happen. And I think what this war that emphasizes compassion and insight makes a lot of sense in one sense, but the other side of it is I'm not unconvinced that we haven't already begun the sixth extinction. Mm-hmm. And if that were the case, don't I want to spend most of my compassion on people who have it worse than I do, on communities that have it worse than I do? And so I don't know if I want to make my goal to prevent the breakdown of the planet and life on Earth as we know it. Maybe I want to pay attention to those of us who are living through it. And so it's I'm all for what you suggested about going back and forth between, I suppose, Keoghan's book and this one, because clearly I'm wrestling with all those issues, mm-hmm. Very deeply, but I can barely make a war on plastic bags in my own home. So I keep wondering, how am I going to participate in war on the corporations and the wealthy nations who are making these stupid decisions, who can't share our vaccinations with these poor people? I'm just not, I get right there and I can't. And so I'm totally, I would even attend all Tuesday classes if you did that, or at least online. But I'm struggling in that area.
Well, I think a huge part of this, and this is where I think applying our spiritual practice, including the practice of Sangha, to these issues can be very, very fruitful and helpful, because I think most of us are, our society has become almost entirely individualistic. And those corporations, they planned, they carefully manufactured the situation that makes each of us feel individually responsible for the situation and unable to do anything about it because we're just one person. We're in a toxic system. But that is that is getting stuck in that individualist mindset. We can't do this by ourselves. But if we think about it in terms more like, and I'm not saying this is straightforward or easy, right? But if we kind of shift into this wartime mindset, and maybe you think of it in terms of the war on global heating, but that's, like I said, that is just a symptom of the toxic way that we have been living. So if you think of it on a war on greed, hate, and delusion, then it is also a war on the situation that ends up, certain of us are protected and a huge portion of the world is not. In which case, if it's all a war effort, right? And therefore, every way that we contribute in a positive way helps. then your role might be immediate compassion for the people around you, taking care of, you know, people who are suffering in your immediate community, because that is part of, you know, keeping society stable. That is part of helping those people have more resources to respond to difficulty. So each of us is going to have our own way that we can contribute. Some of us are going to be able to like head to the front lines, and some of us are going to make a podcast about it. So I don't know. I'm sure that didn't begin to answer your questions, but Bob.
Hi. I like what you just said. I think it's difficult to remain focused on our practice and to have a real faith and belief and confidence that our practice will affect people around us. And sometimes, as you said, and I really agree with this, those are the people that you can do the most with, unless you're Elon Musk, you know, or somebody like that. But for the rest of us, I think it's very important to remember that our practice was always against greed, anger, and ignorance. This is no different than before. Maybe we might individually think there's more of it than we had before. But always it comes down to the belief, I guess, and the confidence and that, you know, we can make a difference. And everything we see that is clearer, and everything that we can help to clarify for ourselves and for other people will have an effect. And that, as you said, takes many different forms. But to have that confidence, you know, I really empathize with Pat, because I think at times I'm kind of like throwing in the towel and saying, oh, geez, you know, what can we do, really? But I like the vision, the idea that if we're going to go down the drain, we're circling the drain, let's all hold hands, because it's not fun to go by yourself. You know, it's better to be in touch with somebody. And that's what our practice is all about. Thank you.
Yes. And I do think, you know, we need to reimagine what we think ourselves capable of. Because sometimes all we can think of is our individual, my individual sphere in life. I know this many people and I can, you know, decline this many plastic bags and, you know, I'll do what I can. But once again, that's limited to just my little individual sphere. But if we see ourselves as part of something greater, I mean, in a sense, we can't do any more as an individual than we've been doing. But if we're part of something greater and we take responsibility for the greed, hate, and delusion beyond our own sphere, I don't know. I believe there's great potential there. So we're a little bit over time, but I'll, you know, log off if you need to. But Brian, our last question.
Well, what I know about war of the sort of the scale that you're describing, I get from my dad and from my uncles and for that generation. The greatest generation was in World War II. And the two kind of most relevant themes that kind of popped to mind were that war entailed a great deal of self-development. So my dad was smart, but poor, couldn't go to college. And so he tested into being a bombardier navigator. And so, and I think that was generally the case for lots of people. Success meant lots of people didn't just plug in, but also had to cultivate their talents and find application for them. The second dimension that really came through was the notion of we are all in it together, and that is a great salad mixing. And so it really does require figuring out how to talk to people who come from a very different perspective and than you might, that I might. I remember being in a discussion with someone who defiantly and dismissively said, "What does sustainability even mean?" And it blurted out of me, because I'm from a rural part of upstate New York. It means that if you like fishing, don't overfish. And I think it may sound condescending in the retelling, but at the time it wasn't. It's really like you and I know that this is really what it means. And you can extrapolate from that to other contexts, but bottom line, that's what it means. Mm. And I think that for people who do cherish, and we all cherish differently, the natural world, you know, watching it go up in flames quite literally is heart-wrenching. And it may touch us for different reasons. Our experience in that natural world may be different, but at any rate, I think that those are the, you know, taking and reflecting on this idea of conceptualizing this moment in time as total war. I think those are kind of two dimensions that it puts me in mind of. So.
Thank you. I really love that. You know, like, I think, I'm sure it's not a perfect analogy, but I'm sure there's, you know, it took a long, long, long time for America to get into World War II. Like, let's keep that in mind, right? Oh, and then it had this great mobilization, but people did not want to do it until finally, okay, fine, right? Now I guess we got to do this. So it could be that, right? Like, we could be a growing number of people who are saying, you know, we got to mobilize like never before, but then there'll just be a critical mass at which point it can happen. Let's hope.
If people do get sick of it, they get tired of it, it breeds a cynicism because there's a lot of waste and idiocy in wartime efforts. And it really, I think, is kind of circling back to the greater good, the higher purpose that gets you through, you know, having to endure the,
you know, it's going to be a mess. Like, Extinction Rebellion talks about forming citizens assemblies and, you know, and it's just like, yeah, that's probably going to be a mess. But, you know, what are we going to do? We got to do something. We got to do our best. And we'll see what happens. But I love, like, the self-development part of, like, you know, women came out of the household to become, you know, Rosie the Riveter. People did all kinds of stuff that they never pictured themselves capable of doing or wanting to do. Well, thank you everyone for a really, I don't know. Please share with me more ideas if you're chewing on this and you find it interesting or inspiring. And let me say my closing. And it looks like Ruth Ann had something she wanted to say, but I'll say my closing and then stay on. Abiding in this ephemeral world, very appropriate, like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. And if anybody is curious about any of my references or whatever, this was essentially my podcast episode this week, so you could just look on the podcast website and that will have all your info. So Ruth Ann.
Oh, yes. Thank you for today's talk. Buddhism doesn't exist to me, never did, in a bubble. And the reason I personally joined a sangha is I needed a spiritual community, not just, you know, the ways a person could practice Zen, but to have that sense on some level of a community. So thank you for the book reference too. I'm going to get that from Powell's.
All right. Excellent. Yeah.
And courage.
Yeah, go ahead.
Virtue. Courage is the first and best virtue because, you know, you don't have to be courageous first. You just, it's inside of each of us. You just tap it to even look at anything. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, everyone. Have a good day.
You as well. Bye-bye.